scene. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have to say that over the last few years, some of the most exciting morning show conversations have occurred around a marvelous theatrical undertaking at Carthage, their Verbatim Theater Project, which began, if I remember correctly, some 10 years ago. So I'm so glad that we can be talking about yet another Verbatim Theater Project, which is going to be presented to the public this coming weekend. It's called Terminal Exhale, and it involves the troubling, tragic phenomenon of gun violence. And this is, of course, a scourge on modern life in so many different ways. But Terminal Exhale examines the impact of gun violence through the eyes of frontline healthcare workers, who, of course, face this trauma on a very regular basis. And this project helps us to understand what they see, what they experience, what they feel as they intersect with this tragedy on the front lines of emergency rooms across the country. Joining me today is, first of all, Martin McClendon, professor of theater, who has been at the helm of Verbatim Theater at Carthage right from the start. And I'm also really happy to welcome to the program Deborah Kelly, who is chair of the social work department at Carthage. And she was a hands-on participant in the Verbatim project from a few years ago, which examined the experience of healthcare workers in the most difficult days of the COVID-19 pandemic. And she is on hand as well because she has a very real and personal devotion to the cause of gun violence prevention and is a member of Moms Demand Action. And she has been part of this particular project nearly from the start, and we will be talking with both of them about this. And before we go any further, we want to remind you or alert you to the fact that there is only one weekend of shows, one weekend of performances of Terminal Exhale, and they're occurring in the intimate studio theater at Carthage Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, 7:30, and Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, with seating very limited. So you should not delay if you feel any interest in experiencing this for yourself. Martin McClendon, Deborah Kelly, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Martin, since it is 10 years of Verbatim Theater, I think it would be appropriate for us to begin with just at least a sketch of the history of this. And maybe right at the outset, we should say that this is something not invented by Carthage. This is a concept that has been around for a while, but certainly something that Carthage has taken and really run with in a very exciting way. Tell us kind of a longer-term sketch of Verbatim Theater itself and then how it became such an important part of Carthage's theatrical program.
Thanks. Thank you, Greg, for having us on again. Yes, so it kind of is an outgrowth of what you might call documentary-style theater, which came about in the 19-teens up into the 1930s. The Federal Theater Project here in America, for instance, which was a New Deal program to put out-of-work artists back to work, created several kind of famous productions examining things like homelessness in America, called One Third of a Nation, taking stories right from the headlines. There was also something called the Patterson Strike Pageant, which was the dramatization of a very famous strike and lockout of textile workers in Patterson, New Jersey, to kind of show that, you know, reading about it in the newspaper was one thing, but seeing stories being told live in a theatrical performance is so much more compelling in some ways. And obviously, newspaper journalism is necessary and impactful, but when you see people sort of living out the stories in front of you, there's something different that gets triggered in your brain, I think, than just reading matter. Fast forward to the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when portable tape recorders become available, and people really start to connect that with theater. And so they take a tape recorder out and they interview people in a way that they hadn't ever been able to do before, at least not easily. And England really becomes the place where verbatim theater starts to take a foothold there. They have, a larger amount of federal or government subsidy for the arts there. And so lots of different verbatim theater artists got started just in their communities with a little bit of money to pay for a tape recorder and to tell the stories of their communities. But America has had some very famous examples as well. The Laramie Project is probably the most famous verbatim play ever written here in America about the killing of the hate crime killing of Matthew Shepard, in which 200 people were interviewed in Laramie, Wyoming by the Tectonic Theater Project to create the Laramie Project. And that took America by storm in the 90s. And so, inspired by all that, 10 years ago here at Carthage, myself and a student, Laurel McKenzie, decided, well, what if we tried this? And we chose as our subject the war in Afghanistan, which at that point had been going for 15 years, and it didn't seem like there was any end in sight. And we were sort of like, well, what's going on here? And what about the people who had to fight this war, and how are they feeling about all this? And so we created the first verbatim play with Carthage Theater called Afghanistan, Wisconsin. And since then, over the last 10 years, we've done about 7 or 8 of these plays. I now teach a verbatim class, we got a couple of different awards for it, from the American College Theater Festival for 10 years of this work. And, I really got to hand it to the students, especially in the program, who are oftentimes the ones doing the interviewing or the editing and the writing, transcribing too. Without the students, this program would have gone nowhere. It's just tough to do that all yourself. And as well as the assistance of fellow faculty, not only in theater, but also mostly in social work with Becky Hornung and Debbie Kelly, and then also Nancy Reese in nursing, and several of the other nursing professors who have, especially in the last couple of years, just unstintingly provided their time, their expertise, and then also just collaborated on several of our past projects that are revolving around healthcare. Hmm.
Explain to our listeners who've not had the pleasure of being in the audience for one of these performances what this theatrical experience is like compared to, at the risk of, I don't know how to say this, but, a more normal or more common kind of theatrical experience when you're going to see The Importance of Being Earnest or Once Upon a Mattress or whatever it might be. I mean, in what way do these performances resemble that kind of theatrical experience that most people have had quite often?
Yeah, great question. I guess I'll answer first by just saying the way we create these scripts is we interview people. And so we already create a battery of questions that we use in order to get folks talking about the topic and whatever the topic is or our thesis is or whatever it is. So we've already sort of determined somewhat the structure of the play through the questions we're going to ask. That doesn't mean that they can't talk about other things that they want to talk about, but when we're then putting it together, there's already a bit of a structure to it. And so, for this one, the verbatim class decided that we would talk first about their early experiences and how they got into healthcare, then their first encounter with gun violence, and then what happens in the trauma bay, right? So you sort of take a step up each time. And so in that way, it is like an actual, quote unquote, actual play, in that you're increasing the tension, you're increasing the complication of the story as you move forward through time to some kind of climax, right? To some kind of event or something. And after that comes what we call the falling action or the resolution of that, which is where people start to reflect on, well, what does this event mean? And what is this event doing to me and to society? And how do we change this? And so that kind of brings the downward glide again back to earth, right? So it does have a bit of a similar structure to a play, but of course it doesn't involve you know, the kind of suspense of, will the hero get the girl, or will the, you know, can we raise enough money to save the high school gym or whatever? You know, these are not the concerns. And so, you know, in some ways we leave the resolution up to the audience, right? So as they walk out at the end, they're asking themselves, well, what can I do about this? Or what can we do about this? Or what, you know, what does this really mean? Or did my views change, or that kind of thing? So because it's made out of interviews, the dialogue, quote unquote, is really between the actors and the audience too. As our interview participants answered the questions, we then turn it around and we create characters out of those people, and they talk to each other and they talk to the audience. So there's a lot of interaction with the audience on a subtle level, in terms of the audience is the other character in the play. So no, you won't be asked to get up and dance or anything like that, but you are sort of engaged in a way that maybe you wouldn't be in a quote unquote regular play.
How about the V word? How literally do you take that concept? How seriously that concept of verbatim versus taking the words of, let's say, I mean, ordinary people in the sense of non-theatrical people, people maybe telling their story for the very first time, and perhaps in ways that we might regard as perhaps sort of unpolished. Is it necessary for you to take their words and, in a sense, reshape them or polish them in a way to make them more effective on the stage, or to at least some extent, do you really strive to be sharing their thoughts and their stories verbatim in a literal sense of the word?
Another great question. So it's kind of a mix of both. So we transcribe the interviews very carefully so we don't miss a single word, first of all. But then, you know, and the other good thing is that most people are actually pretty natural storytellers, you know. I mean, obviously, you know, you have that friend who always tells the greatest stories at parties, right? And so some people are better at it than others. But we as theater makers, that's kind of our specialty, is we take your story and we make it into something compelling, right? Even, you know, we may find the grains of wheat in the straw or whatever, right? We want to help all of our participants to appear to be the experts, which is what they are. They are the subject matter experts of what we are asking them about. So sometimes we do have to edit and streamline stories. You know, we'll remove a lot of the interjections like and and, you know, and things like that, because if those are all left in, it kind of clutters up the message, and it also lengthens the play. So we have a time limit, obviously. So we take away things and we edit things, but we never add anything, if that makes sense. So we are not interpreting their words. We're not making up things and adapting what they say. The words you will hear when you come to Terminal Exhale were all spoken by the 11 people that we interviewed. Nothing that we have there is made up.
For those of you just joining us, we're hearing today on the morning show from Martin McClendon, professor of theater at Carthage, who has headed up over the last 10 years their Verbatim Theater Project. And the most recent iteration of that is going to be performed this coming weekend. It's called Terminal Exhale, and it involves the specter of gun violence here in America as viewed through the eyes of frontline healthcare workers in emergency rooms across the country. And joining us as well today, and we're going to hear from her now, is Deborah Kelly, who is chair of the social work department. And she became involved with the Verbatim Theater Project back around the time of the COVID-19 pandemic, when the trauma experienced by frontline healthcare workers during those incredibly difficult days was chronicled and expressed in that particular Verbatim Theater Project. Deborah Kelly, first of all, it's great to have you here. And I wonder if you would take us back to when you first became part of Verbatim Theater, and how was that connection made? Who called who? Who came knocking on whose door? Just tell us about what it was like to become part of this.
Sure. Thank you so much. And just to clarify, I am not the chair of the social work department. And so Becky Hornung, who is our chair, she's actually been involved with Verbatim Theater from the beginning. And so I came in a little bit later. Honestly, I don't remember if I reached out to Martin or if Martin reached out to me, but my recollection of the way that this sort of unfolded is that my specialty area in social work is mental health and trauma. And one thing that we know about frontline mental health workers, frontline trauma workers, who are often social workers and do the type of work that I have done for my entire career, end up with what we call secondary trauma. So what that refers to is that doing the work and hearing the stories on a day-to-day basis of people who have been directly exposed to trauma has an insidious mental health impact on the workers themselves. And they end up with some of the very same outcomes and symptoms of PTSD as people who directly experienced the horrors that they might be coming into a mental health treatment program to address. And so, and then the other piece is, so I've been teaching a semester class on the subject of psychological trauma since 2019. And one of the textbooks from my class, perhaps the most well-known book on the subject of psychological trauma, is written by Basil van der Kolk. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. And what most people don't realize is that Basil van der Kolk dedicates two chapters of his book to the topic of theater as a pathway to trauma recovery. So when most people think about how do you recover from trauma, they think about talk-based therapies. Well, what we know is that trauma experiences are not stored in the language centers of our brains. And so while certainly talk-based therapy has helped many people to recover, once we really understand the neurobiology of trauma, there are many components to trauma that cannot be accessed by talk-based therapies alone. And so there's programs like Shakespeare in the Prisons and Martin's Verbatim Theater program, where trauma is a little bit more of an embodied experience where people can, for lack of a better word, sort of play with their stories in a different way, gain a sense of agency, empowerment, a retelling of their story in a way that allows them to maybe have more of a sense of control. Sometimes watching somebody else sort of act out what happened to them can allow them to experience the emotions that were often frozen in the moments of the trauma, and they can experience it in a more active and accessible way. And so it is a pathway to sort of reworking the trauma in some very, very powerful ways that are often, it's just not something that often in talk-based therapies we're able to accomplish. And so it's something that I think of as a high impact pathway to trauma recovery.
Hmm. I'm curious if he or others, or you in your own studies, have explored the possibility that even just once in a while, something like this could have the opposite effect. I'm just curious if sometimes seeing one's own trauma portrayed on the stage, especially in a really vivid way, might have the effect of triggering deeper trauma or revisiting trauma. I guess one of the reasons I'm prompted to ask the question is because of so often now when we go to all kinds of different things, and especially theatrical productions, we're going to be told that, well, there's this potential trigger and this potential trigger and this and this, and as though people need to go into a theatrical experience, in a sense, on guard, in case the themes of this particular play might touch on something deep and painful, which might be a really legitimate concern. But then here's something like Verbatim Theater that is taking on these things in a way that is not at all sort of peripheral or in the background, but front and center. Is it ever a cause of greater pain rather than healing for someone who has experienced this kind of trauma?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I may be having to give you a sort of unsatisfying response to that. And the response is like, maybe, right? Because human beings are somewhat unpredictable. In fact, one of the favorite quotes I share with my students in the social work program is that social work is not rocket science. It's actually much harder than that, because in something like rocket science, you have like stable, predictable conditions where you can, I mean, I'm sure there's some very complex math formulas that I don't understand, but in social work, you know, you can do the same intervention with 10 different people and have 10 different responses to it, right? But there are many different theater-based programs aimed at trauma recovery, and they're all slightly different. And so certainly, you know, a physician who works in an emergency room who has maybe been diagnosed with PTSD because of all of the trauma that they've experienced, coming to see the Verbatim Theater production would be a qualitatively different experience than a theater program where they would be given a role and actually acting it out themselves, right? So like there's not one size fits all of like theater programs aimed at trauma recovery. And oftentimes the pathway to trauma recovery is not a straight line. It's not a straight line from, you know, feeling, you know, overwhelmed by your trauma to, you know, then suddenly one day you're like cured, right? And the pathway to recovery often does involve, you know, sitting with your pain, sitting with the details of what happened to you, perhaps memories that had been hidden from your consciousness come back at different times, and that can be, you know, disturbing, to say the least. But what are some of the unique aspects of theater that we believe are consistent with what people need to recover from trauma? Community is one. So most often trauma feels like a very isolating experience, and that we strongly believe that recovery needs to happen within community and for other people to sort of bear witness to and validate that what happened to you was horrific. And so some of that validation within community, because so much of trauma is kind of like stuff we don't talk about at the dinner table. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a taking action component. So like oftentimes, as I mentioned, in trauma, we are really frozen, whether it's physically, like some traumas, you know, people are literally being held down by a perpetrator and they literally can't respond in the moment. Physiologically, we're in like a fight or flight state where all of our body systems are saying, fight back, get away, right? But like, because of this immobilization, whether it's, you know, real or perceived, you know, we can't take action. And so theater by its nature is about being active in sort of replaying someone's story, and so it can enable some of those things to happen. You know, there's other things like patterned repetitive activities that are very re-regulating of our central nervous system, and so like singing and dancing, a lot of people don't understand, but like we know the arts are healing, and that's what we're sort of learning, is that re-regulating our nervous system can really come through things, and this play does not have singing or dancing. So I don't want to like, you know, raise expectations, but again, there's just different types of theater programs that have been found to be extremely beneficial to trauma survivors.
Of that, I have no doubt. Martin McClendon, I just wonder if you have anything to add to Professor Kelly's, I think, marvelous and thorough response to that question.
Yeah, and thank you, Debbie, for that. I think it's some of the things that we try to take into consideration are when we embark on a verbatim project, we try to follow sort of research guidelines as much as we can. So we have all of our students train with IRB guidelines, right? Institutional Review Board for those in the non-academic world. And so we do things like we offer confidentiality to people if they don't want to be identified. We can remove anything from the transcript that might be uncomfortable for them, right? We're not going to just put it all out there. We always have our participants look at the text before it goes before the public. We also advise them that there could be potentially effects, right? So this could be an uncomfortable situation that you're getting into because, again, you're telling stories about something that was traumatic. You know, and on the other end of it, I certainly have, for the most part, heard, you know, expressions of, I guess it wouldn't be exactly gratitude, but expressions of feeling seen by people who have seen their stories on stage. Sometimes they do thank us. You know, they will say things like, you've done something really great for me here. Others don't want to come, right? Like, we usually have about 50% attendance by the folks who participate in these projects, I think because they don't want to maybe actually see it. It was hard for them to relive it for us, and they don't really want to see it. And there have been a couple of folks, too, over the 10 years who maybe felt like they went and saw it and they felt impacted in a way that they weren't expecting. So it isn't necessarily that they said, how dare you, or anything like that, but just that you could sort of tell, yeah, this was a profound and moving experience for them in a way that wasn't a celebration necessarily, at least not initially, you know, of their story. You know, the community aspect, I think, is really important because this particular technique allows you to tell your story without getting into the spotlight. An actor is standing in for you. So it's a way, again, to tell people what's going on and to find common ground with other people who are having the same problems, you know, the same issues, without having to stand up and say, this is happening to me. And being in an audience of people who are, you know, gasping as they hear what you went through can be healing, right? To know that you got your story out there, but you didn't have to tell it to this giant group of people. So those are just some of the aspects that are brought to mind by Debbie's description and by your question.
Right. I also want to ask about this matter of that what we're talking about are real stories, actual stories by real people. But those real people will be not on the stage. It will be Carthage students instead. So in a sense, impersonating or standing in for these actual people. So when it comes to the matter of casting and so on, are you concerned that Jimmy X kind of looks like Johnny Y or whatever in terms of these feel like, yeah, this could potentially be that person? Or are we talking about a certain suspension of expectation that this person does not need to literally look like and sound like the person whose story they are sharing? I don't know if that question makes any sense.
It sure does, yeah. And yeah, the short answer is, I mean, some of these verbatim pieces, they're cast before they're even finished. So, you know, what we sometimes are doing is looking for people who can really actively engage with a different kind of text, right? And make it sort of come alive in a way that is, you know, different from a regular quote-unquote play. But in this case, yeah, we had the play almost done by the time we cast Terminal Exhale. And there were, I wouldn't say it was much of a consideration at all. I mean, if we had to find people who looked, you know, or talked exactly like the folks in the play, I think that would have been a pretty much of a hindrance. And I think our actors are fantastic here at Carthage, and they have been able to pick up the natural rhythms that come through when you interview someone. And so they pick up those rhythms and they end up sounding like the people that were interviewed, actually, in an eerie way, because those people said those words in that order, and there's only a certain way in which you can say them and stress them and make them make sense. And so you end up actually sort of retro engineering these words and these people, which is kind of great. And, you know, sometimes actors want to know more about their subjects, and sometimes they don't, you know, and they want to make the character their own. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, these are obviously, these are not people who are 50 years old who've spent 20 years in healthcare. You know, they're people who are 20 years old who've spent 0 days in healthcare. And so for the actors, it's actually been very exciting. We worked with a nursing student named Josh Zamber, who came in. He works in trauma bays, and he kind of consulted with us on trauma bay procedures. The students just ate it up. They loved the, you know, I mean, there's nothing an actor likes better than to impersonate somebody, you know, or to portray somebody, I should say, with these kind of specialized, amazing skills, and to try to get all the details right about what happens in that trauma bay when the patient comes in. So there is that aspect of it too, that, you know, most actors are really excited to take something like this on.
For those of you just joining us, today's morning show is devoted to a really exciting and the latest iteration of the Verbatim Theater Project at Carthage College. This weekend, four performances of Terminal Exhale. And joining us, Martin McClendon, professor of theater, and also with us, Deborah Kelly, who is part of the social work faculty. I promoted her to chair without realizing it, so congratulations, Deborah Kelly. But anyway, they are both here, both very much involved in this latest project with the Verbatim Theater. And this Terminal Exhale deals with gun violence. Deborah Kelly, this is an issue that you care about very, very passionately. I wonder if we could begin by just hearing a little bit about your own concerns about gun violence, because that, of course, is probably the central reason why you are part of this particular Verbatim project.
Yes. Well, yes. So again, I've been interested in Verbatim theater since I realized sort of the connection to trauma. And so, but I don't even know if Martin knew this other part of my life and in my volunteer world, that I've been a volunteer lead with Moms Demand Action, which is part of Every Town for Gun Violence, which is the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country. So I've been involved with them since 2019. And honestly, I credit my own son for, getting me involved in this movement. So it was after Parkland, when my son was 15, that he actually got involved in the gun violence prevention movement. He was the youth lead for March for Our Lives in Milwaukee. And, you know, he really motivated me to get more involved, and he still works in gun violence prevention. Actually, he works for WAVE, the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, which is one of the co-sponsors of this event as well. And so this is just such a unique lens to be taking. So what we know, you know, again, my background as a mental health professional is in trauma. And what I always say is that if you combine trauma and a gun, it's like trauma on steroids, right? And so recognizing that there are some, you know, policies that, you know, 80% or more of the public agrees with, you know, that people in a mental health crisis maybe should not have access to a gun until they are stabilized, because, you know, so much can go wrong in such a short period of time. Where somebody is just very vulnerable, and you know, things like universal background checks, et cetera, you know, safe storage initiatives are things that could really protect people from trauma. And we know that violence with a gun, gun suicides, et cetera, these have so many ripple effects in terms of, I mean, I remember, I think it was in 2022, there was a shooting just off campus at Carthage at a bar half mile away from campus, and 40 Carthage students were in the bar when the shooting happened. But that incident, even though thankfully none of our students were injured, we did have nursing students in the bar that rendered first aid to some of the gun violence victims, and that shooting had a ripple effect across our entire campus. Students in their dorms that didn't know where their roommates were. The campus was on lockdown while the perpetrator was on the loose. And so it was really a community trauma. And I think what oftentimes people don't calculate when they think about gun violence is how those ripple effects are changing people's lives. And so the stories of frontline healthcare workers are kind of an untold story of those ripple effects of gun violence. And the costs, the human costs, the financial costs, the community costs of this epidemic, I just think bringing some of that to light in such a powerful and unique way is something that I knew I really wanted to be involved with, given, you know, the other areas where I have worked and studied.
So explain exactly what your involvement has been with this particular Verbatim Theater project. Again, we're talking about something called Terminal Exhale. It will be performed this coming weekend, four performances in all. What was your hands-on involvement in this particular project?
Yeah, so I did a couple of guest lectures in the Verbatim Theater class. Of course, I also highly recommended the class for social work majors, so I'm proud to say that some of them were in the class. And so, you know, using their interviewing skills in this way was also like fantastic. Like, it's a win-win when our departments can collaborate in these ways and use our skills to complement each other and to educate our students in so many different and exciting ways. So I also came in as a guest lecturer to talk about the connection between trauma and how to be a sensitive interviewer with somebody who has experienced trauma, and also how theater can play a role in trauma recovery. Those were the main topics. And, you know, I've just been helping as an organizer to like get people from the gun violence prevention movement excited. We're doing a conference actually in conjunction with the play on Saturday. We'll have an all-day conference with nationally recognized speakers, some of whom were interviewed for the play, and they will be presenting on what we call secondary trauma, the effects of trauma on those who were not necessarily direct victims of the trauma, but were impacted by it nonetheless, and kind of pathways to healing for those frontline workers. So that we still have some spots open in the conference, and it's free. It's on Saturday, starting at 2:30 in the afternoon. Maybe we can provide some registration information in the show notes or something along those lines. So we do have these. So I've been like just collaborating with Martin on how we can kind of broaden the impact of the play and promote it to a broad audience that might be different than who might normally come to a Carthage Theater production. Mm.
And that's, of course, been one of the most exciting aspects of this Verbatim Theater project, is exactly that, the way in which it has broadened the scope of who comes into either Wartburg Auditorium or the Studio Theater and experiences theater in this way. Martin McClendon, give us some sense of the range of healthcare workers that were interviewed for this project and the nature of the stories that they tended to share.
Sure, and I'm actually going to dovetail onto what Debbie said too, because the whole reason we picked this topic, as opposed to any other topic about trauma or healthcare, was because I met a guy named Michael Cody. So Michael Cody is part of World Premiere Wisconsin, which fosters new works, and so he had come and seen an earlier Verbatim play, and afterward he said, "Hey, I'm also really in the gun violence prevention world. I'm wondering if you could maybe make a play about that." And Michael is the founder of something called Enough Plays to End Gun Violence, which actually fosters teen playwrights to write short plays. It's a national competition that's been held for many years now. So Michael is very high up in this world as well. And so we were able, through a grant, to fund Michael coming into our class last spring. So we not only had Debbie and some of the other folks from social work and nursing come in and do guest spots, but Michael was there too as a seasoned theater practitioner and director. and theater maker. And so I really have to credit Michael with sort of, you know, giving us this lens about gun violence. He had been listening to a Malcolm Gladwell podcast, actually. And I had asked Michael, well, is there a way we can work healthcare into this? Because the nursing department has always been really keen and interested ever since we did our play about the pandemic. And so that's kind of where that all came about. Now, in terms of the people we've interviewed, we have two heads of trauma from George Washington University in DC, as well as from Johns Hopkins. The Johns Hopkins trauma surgeon is named Joseph Sacrin. He's also on the board of BRADY, the oldest gun violence prevention organization in the country. So these are big names who gave us a little time, you know, to share their stories. We also have a really big chunk of folks from the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic, TQOL, up in Milwaukee, which is a groundbreaking clinic where they bring all kinds of recovery modalities into the same room, so that gun violence victims who are recovering get not only physical therapy, but all kinds of other assistance too. It's a really innovative program. And so we've talked to three or four folks from there. We have three people at least who are in pediatrics, because we know that the biggest killer of children from 0 to 19 years old currently in the United States is gun violence. Mm. That's the number one cause of death under age 19. So pediatricians are really on the forefront of trying to move the needle on these issues. We also talked to a physical therapist and also a community activist based in DC who's actually at Howard University right now getting his PhD in trauma recovery. So that's sort of in a nutshell the folks that we are talking to. And many of them, if they don't work daily in the trauma bay or in an emergency room, have had prior experience. There's several nurses and other practitioners or doctors who work in critical care that we talked to, 11 people in total.
We don't have a lot of time, but we could certainly give you a couple of minutes to maybe share a story from one of these workers who was interviewed that maybe had something to say that maybe was a surprise to you or a kind of a moment of revelation. Because, of course, this is something that is being talked about more and more, and thankfully so. I mean, regretfully, so that we need to talk about it. But I mean, we already know something about this. But I suspect that when we come to Terminal Exhale, we're going to be hearing stories that are far outside of anything we have ever encountered or conceived before.
Sure, thank you. I think that the interesting thing for me is that no matter what opinions the folks had that we interviewed, and some of them obviously hate guns with a passion because of what they see every day, but none of them want to take people's guns away. Hmm. It's not possible, right? We have the Second Amendment, and we have a country that has more guns than people, right? There are like 400 million guns out there. It's not possible to take people's guns away. What they want to do is make guns safer, because these are preventable injuries that are happening. And we have several people point out in the play, as they have in real life, this is a bipartisan win, right? I mean, something like 80% of Americans agree on these issues, that we need more to be done about gun safety. And so I was really surprised, because I thought that there would be some people who'd be like, get rid of all the guns, and I can't believe, you know, and abolish the Second Amendment or whatever. No, there isn't any of that. Some of it is just out of pragmatism. But it's also about really, you know, the guns are here, right? It's kind of like a virus. If the virus is here, we have to deal with it somehow, right? And so guns are like an epidemic, and we have to deal with them. They're here. And so I'm hoping that people from both sides of this conversation will come and see just what their neighbors and friends who are in healthcare have to deal with sometimes on a daily basis in order to patch people up, or unfortunately put them in body bags, right? From what is happening with gun violence in America.
I think most of the time when someone is going to a play that is relatively serious, perhaps even a tragedy, that nevertheless the typical playwright tries to leaven that darkness, that heaviness, that seriousness with other sorts of emotions. But in something like this, it's a little hard to imagine it being anything but kind of unrelentingly dark and sorrowful and serious. Is that what people need to be prepared for if they go to see Terminal Exhale?
Somewhat. It's not all bleak, right? we talk about the hope and the progress. There may be one or two chuckles in the play, but, you know, situational chuckles. But, you know, it is very dark, but it's real. I mean, these are things that really happened. This is reality, right, that we're talking about. Now, in terms of, yes, could that be a downer? But think about the resilience and the hope and the amazing strength of these healthcare workers who go in day after day and do it, even when they want to run out of the building and never see another gun injury again, right? I mean, there is so much strength in this play, so much hope, you know, so much like undying hope in the face of this constant barrage of violence, right? It's so inspiring. I'm inspired. I'm moved every night that I see it, and I've seen it a lot now.
Mm. Wow. Deborah Kelly, I can give you 1 minute for a closing thought, and I've been so glad that you've been part of this. Any closing thought, brief, I'm afraid, on Terminal Exhale?
No, absolutely. And I guess I'm not positive if this is happening every night, but the performances that I have seen, there's a talk back after the play. So I do think that Martin is really sensitive to, you know, not just ending this heavy play and like sending people out to their lives. Mm. Then, you know, there's like a panel discussion of experts in the field where people can kind of process what they've heard on the stage. And that also kind of is a community building event for everybody. So it's sort of a way that the audience and some of these experts all get to kind of talk with each other and be in community around the intensity of the emotions surrounding the play. And so I think it is done in a way that is very thoughtful of people's mental health and well-being.
Very good. Martin McClendon, what should people do if they want to seek out any of the few remaining tickets to see Terminal Exhale?
Great. So, yeah, go to carthage.edu/tickets, I believe, is where we go. But you could also just type in Carthage Terminal Exhale, and it'll take you to the box office and order tickets right there.
Very good. Martin McClendon and Deborah Kelly, I commend both of you for your involvement in this very, very important project. And I can well imagine how life-changing it has been for those directly involved, and how life-changing it might potentially be as well for those who come to experience it this weekend. Performances Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, 7:30 p.m., Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock in Carthage's Studio Theater. Thank you to both of you for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
I wanted to add a quick word about the event that is happening Saturday afternoon on the campus of Carthage. It's titled Healing the Healers, Approaches to Gun Violence Exposure and Recovery. It's happening in the Wartburg Auditorium, beginning with check-in at 2 o'clock. This is a free event, and several different experts from both the Milwaukee and Chicago area will be on hand. The event is co-sponsored by the Carthage Nursing, Social Work, and Theater Departments, along with Every Town for Gun Safety and the 80% Coalition. Free admission covers the afternoon program as well as a buffet dinner and then that evening's theater performance. Space is limited. Advance registration is required. You can go to carthage.edu/healers for more information. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show, we continue to talk theater. This time we talk about the Kenosha Unified School District's production of The Prince of Egypt with Kristen Singer. This is a special pilot production. It's a great honor for a school district like Kenosha to be given such an opportunity by Music Theater International. Also, we'll be hearing about the latest comedy that is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild, Always a Bridesmaid. And on Friday, two interesting interviews about mathematics. First, the author of a wonderful new graphic novel for young readers called Very Bad at Math. The title character, like the author, suffers from something called dyscalculia, which is related to dyslexia but involves the swapping of numbers rather than letters. And then the author of How Math Explains the World. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Partly sunny today and a high of 53 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. Overnight, a few clouds rolling in, a low of 34. Cloudy to mild with a 40% chance of morning rain and a high of 56 degrees. Friday, a chance of rain in the morning, then sunshine, and look at that, a high on Friday of 73. This is WGTD HD.